Pivot, everyone. On today's episode is Larry, the professor of Asian studies. His father had to run away from Nazi Germany because he was Jewish. About Asia, Asian women, culture, languages, and much more in today's episode. Please welcome Larry.
I'm glad we got connected this morning, and I was looking forward to our morning coffee. That's how I look at this. And when you said about your father being from Germany and some Russian blood you have in the family as well, I get really curious to hear about this connection. And if you could tell me a little bit about the story of immigration, how your family ended up in the United States being from Germany.
Well, my personal experience, not only with my students who come from all over the world, from Asia, Africa, and so on, and my friends in the orchestra who come from all over the world, including a number of Russian colleagues, and so on, but just my very personal experience with my own family is a microcosm of the American immigrant experience that you and I both like to celebrate. My wife is from China. My father escaped Hitler in 1939 from Germany, which I'll elaborate on. And then my mother, both her parents escaped with their families from Russia in the early 20th century to escape the pogroms, the hateful actions that in the Tsarist days they took against Jewish families. And neighbors, next door neighbors, whom I'm friends with, are from Pakistan, both the husband and wife, and not that many years ago, and so on. And my brother-in-law is from Denmark. So this is America, and this is what we should celebrate. But to answer your question specifically about my nuclear family, so my father was born in 1900 in Berlin. And when I was born, I was his first child, 50 years younger than he was. So, but he was born in 1900 in Berlin to an upper middle class family, a Jewish family. They were the only Jewish family in the really nice suburb of Berlin, Zehlendorf. And so, and my dad encountered a little bit of anti-Semitism in school, maybe more than a little bit, but nevertheless, he was the best student in his classes, although the teachers loved to denigrate him occasionally because he was a Jew, but okay. And he entered the University of Berlin Law School. When he was 20 years old, his father was fairly prosperous, worked for the German government in forestry, and was sent to Russia, as well as across Germany and other parts of Europe, Eastern Europe, to explore forests there for logging.
Interesting.
And in doing so, he made a good living, but he died of pneumonia from exposure in the elements in the winter. Yeah. And so that was when my father was 20 years old and about to finish law school at the University of Berlin. So he dropped out of law school because he and his mother, and this was right after World War I, and we know the reparations Germany had to pay. So inflation was just rampant, and you needed, as my dad said, as you might have heard, a whole wheelbarrow full of money to go purchase a loaf of bread and so on.
Right.
My dad went into business with his mother, providing trousseaus for wealthy families in Germany, especially Berlin. Trousseaus, and that day, as part of the dowry of the bride, she had to provide all the linen and towels and so on. And in doing that, dad had to go to various German firms, manufacturing firms that made towels and sheets and all of this that would be part of the bridal dowry. So he became of sorts a salesman. But in 1936, he was 36 years old, and Hitler had come to power. He could see the handwriting on the wall, as could a lot of Jews, although they had no idea what was really going to come. And he fled to, or not fled, but he went to Barcelona, Spain, where he had relatives. And the Spanish Civil War broke out. And that was even more dangerous at the time than Germany. So he went back to Germany. Well, in 1939, finally, seeing that they didn't know about the concentration camps yet, but they knew that had lost his jobs first in 1936 with Hitler coming to power. Jews couldn't work for any Aryan firm, for any firm that wasn't Jewish. And then Hitler, by 1939, was shutting down all Jewish businesses, period. And so my dad had to leave, and he left his mother behind because she felt too old to be able to travel. My dad was able to leave Germany legally, although knowing almost no English, virtually no English, and able to take almost nothing with him. By the way, how is this possible? Because the U.S. did take in a lot of Jewish people fleeing Hitler, but a very small percentage of those who applied. And American anti-Semitism has been around. It's nowhere as virulent now as it was in the earlier part of the 20th century, but it's still with us. Jews will not replace us. Oh, there are good people on both sides, right, says Trump. Anyway, we know. So, anti-Semitism is still with us, but it's not so strong. And so the U.S. didn't take in anywhere as many Jewish people as they could have saved, but thank God they did take in some. And the reason my dad was able to come was that he wasn't living in a Jewish ghetto or whatever, so he wasn't immediately rounded up or anything. And he was friends with a woman who was the nanny for this wealthy American family that would spend summers in Germany. And that wealthy family, the father was the CEO of U.S. Steel in Gary, Indiana, where they were positioned. And so this friend of my father's said to this wealthy U.S. family, I know this man in his 30s, Ernst Hertzberg, and yeah, he's a Jew, but he's too good to die. And so can you help save him, bring him to America? So this steel magnate and his wife arranged for my dad to get a visa to come to America and stay with this family in Hammond, Indiana. This family had a daughter around my dad's age who they had been trying to marry off, and she wasn't the most attractive woman.
I think I know what's coming.
That's right. My dad would be a perfect candidate for this. My dad was very cultured, loved poetry and classical music and so on, had been friends with the head of the German theater in Berlin, gotten complimentary tickets to all their performances, and was a young poet. Everything wrote some really beautiful romantic poetry. Anyway, so they thought, oh, this would be wonderful. So my dad was able to stay with them. But the job then, when he arrived at age 39, knowing virtually no English at all.
He was speaking English. German only, right?
Yes. Yes. Okay. Only German, because he didn't know that he was going to have to emigrate at age 39.
Right.
And
right.
In those days, Germans didn't learn English like they do now. And,
exactly.
And so the head of U.S. Steel said, well, I'll get you a job working in the steel mills in Gary, Indiana. My dad, who was not a physical man at all, he was definitely a white collar, not a blue collar worker,
sure,
said, no, thank you. Give me a little bit of seed money to go to New York, just a little bit of money so I can go to New York City and see if I can't get a job doing what I was doing in Germany, which is representing firms that deal with textiles. And my dad was successful. He was very enterprising. And we know this, Anya, immigrants like you, like my Chinese wife, and so on, my Pakistani neighbor, they tend to be people who are very enterprising and are brave enough to leave their home country and enter a strange land with a strange language and make their way. And they do to an amazing extent in this country. And so my dad got hired by a number of-
I'm sorry. I just want to stop you for a second here. You just touched a very interesting point. You said that immigrants are more enterprising. Do you have the explanation why? Because you are not the first person I hear it from. And I'm just curious, what's the driving force for us to be more enterprising and proactive?
Well, as you know, Anya, there are a number of reasons why immigrants come to the U.S. Some are escaping persecution in their own countries, like my German father escaping Hitler, and my great-grandparents from Russia escaping the pogroms, anti-Semitism there, and then to a lesser extent, my Chinese wife, who is a writer, was a writer in China, and at that time, China was so repressive. She left in 86. Things were beginning to loosen up, but it wasn't a great country to be a writer in. Still isn't. I came to the U.S. Others come just because they see our country as a land of opportunity, of jobs. But no matter how dire the situation in your home country or how much you would like to seek a better life in the U.S., you're not going to come if you're not self-confident enough and brave enough to do that, to come across the ocean or whatever, to come to this strange land where you possibly know no one and where you don't know the language well. And so, for example, my dad was engaged to be married to a German woman, and he said, come with me to America, and she didn't dare. She just thought it was too big undertaking to do.
And be scary risky. For some people.
And my grandmother, my dad's mother, because of her age, of course, knowing no English and whatever, just couldn't see herself making a life in a new country. Well, she committed suicide in hiding from the Nazis.
To hear that.
Oh, no, thank you. And so the people who come do tend to be brave enough and enterprising enough. So and hardworking enough, ambitious enough, and so on, or desperate enough, or both. To come. And so we see this, and and hence immigrants tend to be very, very successful in this country if they have any education. And we have to say that, because my Chinese wife, highly educated, one of the most brilliant, best educated of Chinese people, for someone like her to succeed, it was hard enough. For someone like you to succeed, it's hard enough as an educated person. The immigrants who come illegally, for instance, across the border, I still applaud them. We actually need them to do the jobs
right,
that Americans are willing to do.
Exactly.
So know that and celebrate that. But it's a lot harder for them. And my Chinese wife said, when you're doing this interview with Anya, don't pretend the American dream is possible for everyone. I mean, it is possible for everyone,
yes.
But it's
lot
harder.
Thank you for saying this. And thank you to your wife that she brought it up. They picture American dream as something that is done like this very easily, but it's not. There are so many things we have to overcome, and one of them is the language barrier, right? You can be confident, you can be brave, but if you don't speak a language, and you and me, we know like nobody else, it's one of the biggest obstacles when people come to this country. I was fortunate enough, I came here with a bachelor's degree in English and French and education. Yes, even though I had to deal with things in order to integrate into the society, to start thinking like this country, to start to understand why the law works this way and why people have this kind of life here in this country, right? So I, of course, could live with my Russian mentality in the Russian community, and that would be my future. But like you said, we come for the opportunities, and those opportunities are not clearly seen in the beginning. So you have to figure out the way, and you have to figure out yourself first what you want. And that's what happened to me. One day I decided to start living my American dream and figuring out the steps, and here I am. And am I there yet? No, I'm still on my journey. And that's why I'm so excited to talk to you today, because it's fascinating what you're saying about your father. And you started telling that he wanted to go to New York and he was looking for some financial support. Did he eventually go to New York to pursue his career?
He did. But he had to represent a number of firms in the beginning, each one of which only paid him a modest income. And one of those firms, it turned out, was a cover for a Nazi spy ring. And here's my Jewish father, unknowing, and I think they were a chocolate company, and he was representing these chocolates. So in the middle of the night, my dad is arrested by the U.S. government. After coming here to escape Hitler, my dad was accused of being a Nazi spy because,
of course,
he was working for this Nazi spy ring, unbeknownst to him. And he was imprisoned at Fort Sheridan for, I can't remember, was it 3 months or 6 months? And he was imprisoned with white-collar Nazis. So here's my Jewish dad, and it was so bizarre. But they realized their mistake finally. It took the U.S. government, because this is wartime, you have to understand, of course.
Sure.
It took him 3 to 6 months to figure out that this Jew is probably not a Nazi. and let him go without any apology or any money in the middle of the night. And his landlord didn't want to let him back in because he thought maybe my dad really was a Nazi. And World War II is raging. This is, I think the U.S. had just entered the war. But eventually my dad got hired by a German Jewish immigrant, a company that was starting up in New York called Vera. And it became a huge sensation that company did in the U.S. And they became the premier company in the U.S. for providing scarves, middle-priced, beautiful silkscreen scarves for American women. And they were extremely popular. And then they branched out to other things, towels and
of course, after the wartime, everybody wanted to look cute.
Oh, absolutely. But they were people who are now in their 70s, 80s, 90s in America. The women all know Vera. They were bought out long ago. And it was run by these German Jewish immigrants. And Vera was the name of the woman who founded the company. That was her first name. And my dad became their first salesman in the Midwest, and he became very successful and was able to make a upper middle class income and settle us in what then in the U.S., the North Shore of Chicago, was the wealthiest or one of the two wealthiest places in the U.S. We were hardly one of the wealthier families, but nevertheless, and I got a fantastic education there. But so my dad did live the American dream. Granted, it helped that he was not only enterprising, but educated, cultured, and so on. And his clients, he sold to Marshall Fields, Jacobson's out of business now, Macy's and whatever. He was the first salesman in the whole giant Midwest territory. And he was so successful, they kept taking pieces out of his territory and giving it to a new representative. But he worked till he was 79. And made this upper middle class income and allowed my sister and me to get a great education at considered the top high school in the U.S., public high school, Nutrier High School, still in existence in the North Shore. And then go to universities and so on. But again, I get interviewed by students at my university where I teach Chinese and Japanese, as you know. I've gotten interviewed every year for the last decade or more by students of mine who are studying Chinese or Japanese with me, but who are assigned in their basic freshman English class to write an essay on the American dream. And to do that,
interesting. So this is not the first one for you.
No, although you and I are talking more about the immigrant experience. And their question was, what about the American dream for American-born people?
Interesting.
And what they were supposed to ask in an interview, they were supposed to interview at least one person, and my students get very close to me, so they feel really comfortable with me. So, and the question was, is the American dream a reality? Is it still alive? And did it ever really exist? And what I tell them, Anya, every year is that it isn't that easy for people who were born to a poor family, like in the ghetto in Chicago or wherever, Detroit or whatever, maybe a single mom raising them in a crime-ridden neighborhood, where they have a family that doesn't have a high degree of education or whatever and don't have resources. The American dream, it's still possible. But it's always been more difficult. This is a society with great disparity of wealth and educational opportunities and so on. And so, yes, the American dream is possible, especially for enterprising people, whether it's immigrants or American born, if they have the requisite background. And if they don't, we try to provide scholarships, and affirmative action has been so attacked by the right in this country in recent years. I'm a great believer in that, but providing the scholarships and financial help to students from poor families and so on to try to overcome that tremendous gap, that opportunity gap. So yes, the American dream is possible. We still are a country where we have free enterprise and the freedom to start your own business or to be hired in various capacities. But my Chinese wife thinks it's a lot more difficult than it used to be. And I don't know if that's true or not. I think it's always been difficult. The U.S. a century ago seemed a more wide open place for opportunities. And now, of course, the job market is really tough. but and not just because of the pandemic, but even for educated people, I don't mention this to my students, that I concentrate more on, it's harder for minorities. There's still prejudice against, if your skin is brown or black or whatever, you do have a harder time getting hired, although it's not impossible and at all. And it's much better than it was when I was growing up before civil rights. 1964, when the Civil Rights Bill was passed, I was a freshman in high school, for goodness sake. You know, there was still so much segregation. And America is a land of opportunities. We're the number one economy in the world, the richest nation in the world, but we have tremendous disparity of wealth, as I say, as you know, and educational opportunities and so on. But for immigrants who are enterprising like you, my Chinese wife, educated with talents, or my friends, like I had a colleague in the Grand Rapids Symphony. We're one of the top 50 orchestras in this country. We don't pay what the Chicago Symphony does, but we're almost on that level, and it's a full-time job. One of my colleagues was from Japan, and he had a university degree from a conservatory in Japan, really fine violist. And Ken Matsuda comes over to the U.S. He knows virtually no English. The Japanese do have to study English in high school, but they don't really speak it, don't learn to really speak it conversationally. They can read it, but he had to write his essay when he entered graduate school in his basic English class. And the teacher said that, I think it was just for foreign students, but this graduate English class, and they had to write an essay the first day to show what they could do in English. And so the teacher said, okay, I'll give you an hour and write on any subject you want, but let's see what your English level is. And Ken only knew a few words in English. And so he wrote, my favorite composers are Beethoven, Bach, and they gave their full names or whatever. So that he listed every composer he could think of, Claude Debussy and so on, you know, Sergei
Rachmaninoff. That was the entire essay?
This is this essay. And he finished in 5 minutes, and he looks around the class, and the other students are writing.
Still writing, yes.
You know,
yes.
For the rest of the hour. And he's looking around like, so yeah, but he had a special skill. It was going to be my point. So he didn't know English, really. But he had a special skill. He could play the viola as well or better than almost anybody who was American born. And so he got hired, and he'd make a really good living in the Columbus Symphony now in Ohio. So yeah, if you have a special talent like that, or my stand partner Anna Sviersky from Leningrad Conservatory, or my conductor, two of my favorite conductors, both from Russia, these were all Russian Jews who were escaping prejudice there. Semyon Wichkev has become world famous. He had the Orchestre Paris. He came back and conducted. He was the conductor of the Leningrad Symphony for some years. He conducts lyric opera, Ravinia, the Chicago Symphony, and all the time, recordings with Berlin Philharmonic. When he was in his 20s, he was the top young conductor in the Soviet Union, those days of the Soviet Union. And he was scheduled to conduct the Leningrad Symphony, the first Jew to be scheduled to do that, but the government didn't want to allow a Jew to conduct their premier orchestra. And he feared every day a knock on the door at night that he would be arrested. And so he escaped in the middle of the night, came to the US, and had this brilliant career and so on. But they had these special skills. So, or my friend Wiktor Yampolsky, who is conductor at Northwestern University. Sorry, I shouldn't make fun of other people's accents. And as I tell my students, then they won't make
That's
fun.
That's all right. We all do.
But Wiktor Yampolsky, just too fun. He conductor of Northwestern University Orchestra, has a great sense of humor, and he's a fabulous conductor. Well, he was associate concertmaster and associate conductor of the Moscow Philharmonic. So someone of that talent comes to the U.S. and even before he could speak English really well, he got hired right away. He got hired as principal second of the Boston Symphony with a huge salary because, I mean, here's this fabulous player. And he's had this wonderful career too. So American dream, yeah. I mean, if you're that talented, or if you're an Anya Enright and you know, have all your skills and language, your wonderful personality and your technological expertise and so on, yeah, you're gonna be successful. And America is still the land of opportunity. If you're not that educated, and especially if you're, or not especially, but in addition, if you have the handicap of being a darker skinned person or whatever, it's a lot harder. So,
it's interesting. It's interesting. You mentioned so many things that I would like to elaborate more. So first of all, let's come back to the language. You mentioned language many times, and we know if there is no communication, no relationships, you can't go anywhere in this country. And your father didn't speak any English when he came here, but then he built a successful career. He was able to provide more than average life to you, your family. How did he pick up the language eventually?
That's a very good question. When I got in university and older than that, I became my dad's best friend. Before that, he was, tyrannical is too strong a word, but he was this really dominant, strong figure in our household, and we didn't communicate that much at all. And he was really busy providing a good living, but I was basically raised by my loving American mom. So I never asked Anya, I never asked him that question. I know how my Chinese wife learned English, but I don't know how my dad was able to get enough English to be able to represent these firms. Granted, I mean, as a salesman, you have to schmooze, you have to be able to converse with the customers and be charming, which my dad became a master of. I mean, he was that way naturally. He had the personality. And how many salesmen had a university education, were that refined and knew classical music and poetry and theater and so on, could quote Schiller and Heine and so on. And so he was so charming and just extremely polite. But when you're a salesman, you just show things. And so in the beginning, I suppose he didn't have to do that much. And he was very intelligent. I mean, I'm sure he had IQ. He gradually picked it up, I think, just from living here. And it was hard. And I don't think he was living with American family, so that helps.
Okay.
And you learn things. When my Chinese wife came, she was only the second student from China at our university to come. Now we have 50, 60 students a year from China studying at our university, at a university of now only 3,000 students or a little over 3,000 students. So, and we have a huge recruiting effort in China. But then she was only the second student ever. She was 29 and a top graduate of a top university in China, but she had never studied English. She studied a little Japanese. She studied a little bit of Ruskiyazyk. And so on, but
excellent. I like it Russian.
panimals, tri goda ruskim yoziko.
Yay!
Yoziko. I'm sorry. It's been
excellent.
Too long.
Excellent. Yeah. It's not one of the easiest languages. I compliment you.
I'm so sorry. Izvinite.
That's all right.
It's been 40
wonderful.
Years, so when my Chinese wife arrived, they offered her this full scholarship because she had this brilliant record, and we were trying to commemorate she a graduate of our university? Anyway, she was part of our Dutch American community here in West Michigan, who had spent a good part of her life as a missionary in China, and we're a Christian university. And so to celebrate her, there's even a dorm named after her. There's also a scholarship earmarked for Chinese students in her name, done by her sisters after her death. And so my wife received that fellowship. And when she came to our university, it was discovered that she could not speak very much English at all. She had never really studied it. She's very bright. She had watched a TV show from the BBC when she was in China. Learn English with me, I don't know, half an hour a day or whatever. And she did watch that, especially before once she knew she was coming to the US on this fellowship. But when she arrived, it was obvious that she wasn't ready to do university work. And this was a graduate program,
yes,
an education, that she wasn't ready for that. So I helped as the director of Asian Studies. I didn't know this woman from Eve, I found a donor who gave money, believing again in spreading the gospel to China. Great. And so he donated money to allow her to go to Madison, Wisconsin, to an English language school with really good teachers, really small ESL classes, to do intensive English for 6 months. And my wife is brilliant. I mean, she's really, really extremely bright and gifted in many areas, including language. And so she got quite proficient in English in those 6 months. And it helped also watching American TV. And now, I mean, this was the late 80s, 1980s. Well, Jin's been an American citizen for nearly, 30 years now, married to me for 30 years. And her English, I mean, she reads the New York Times and knows American slang with the best of us as well. But at that time, it was hard. But then with those intensive ESL classes, they didn't have those in my dad's day in the 1940s in America, 1950s, we didn't have that. Now there are ESL classes everywhere. Our mutual friend Sue Boldry being a wonderful example of an ESL teacher, and we have ESL programs that I help oversee here in Grand Rapids for Vietnamese Americans, for Bhutanese Americans, and so on. But then but my wife was the beneficiary of one of those programs. And so, it makes the American dream a lot more possible for immigrants these days.
Language definitely helps. I've been working with so many professionals, top professionals who are coming from their countries. One of the recent examples is a business educator from Malaysia. She achieved a very high levels in her country. In her career, but here in this country, she cannot continue her career because of the lack of the language confidence and confidence overall. And here, I think it's very important to have the right support and mentorship. And myself, I'm having so many good mentors around myself. I'm very fortunate with this. And I think it's one of the unique things, like volunteering, love volunteering, believe in volunteering, and mentorship in this country. And to talk to somebody like yourself, who has achieved so many things in life and who has helped and supported so many people in life, it's very encouraging and inspiring, and it can open many different visions. Like even now talking to you, I'm fascinated, and I'm learning so many things from you, and it's such an encouraging experience. And my question to you, it looks like you're still continuing working with so many students, making a difference in their life, and you are teaching Chinese and Japanese, right? So while working with all these different cultures, how do you show them the way to sort of American dream, or what kind of life you can achieve in this country, or anything is possible in this country, any life that you would like to have? Is there secret or advice from Larry to those students from different countries?
Most of my students who are studying Chinese with me, and these days our program got big enough, so I did teach Japanese for 20 years, I don't any longer, but most of the students studying Chinese with me are Americans to whom I need to explain life in China and Taiwan and so on, and the Chinese mentality, Chinese culture. However, every year I do have some students from Korea in each of my classes. I've had as many as 5-6 students from Korea in one of my language classes, but on average I have a couple, and that's true this year. And in each of my Chinese classes, I have a couple students from Korea. I always have, almost always have a student from some African country. Usually it's a different one each year.
Yeah.
This year it's Nigeria, but Uganda, Ghana, and so on. One of our most advanced students in Chinese, if not our very best in Chinese, is from Ghana and came to our university already having learned a lot of Chinese in Ghana. My job is to explain, as I say, Chinese and Japanese culture to American students. However, what I've discovered, because I also hire small conversation group leaders who are native speakers of Chinese, and we do this for Japanese too and continue to do, but for Chinese every year, for each different level of Chinese, I hire a native speaker who's a student at Calvin. And what I've discovered, Anya, in recent years, and I know this from my extensive travels around China, is that these days in urban centers across the world, And especially in more developed countries, in China now, in Beijing, Shanghai, Guangzhou, and so on, represents the life of contemporary people in the US and Europe and Canada and so on. So it's not that different. And what I've discovered with these younger people is they don't have that much difficulty adapting. They've learned English well in their programs in China. The ones who come to America, often they've spent some years of high school here in the US to prepare for that, to go to college, university here. So they don't have a difficulty with the English language. Except maybe when it comes to writing their essays in classes, but in terms of speaking,
which is a
and
big part
sense.
Of this educational system. I do believe essays are very big here, and that's how people express themselves.
No, absolutely. But what I've discovered is over the years are young people coming from China and Japan too, but especially from China, don't have much trouble adapting to life in the US.
Interesting.
Except, I mean, of course, there's the loneliness factor, but that could be true for a
homesickness,
student from
Idaho
or from Georgia or whatever, coming to the Midwest or vice versa, you know, making new friends, that's always an issue. And again, the students who tend to come from countries like China or Africa or whatever, just like other immigrants, tend to have a little bit more self-confidence and backing from their families and so on, and come from more educated families usually, and with means. And so they're able to adapt quite well and make friends with American students. So I haven't really had to counsel them, my Chinese teaching assistants, on how to adapt to life in America. They seem to be doing really, really well.
Interesting.
Yeah, but it helps. The more students we have from China, the more students we have from Korea. We have 150, 160 students from Korea on our campus, not to mention Korean Americans, which we also have. So when you have that support group, then that really helps. And I was going to talk about
absolutely
when my dad came from Germany, there was a large German immigrant community. There was a large Russian community. There still are Spanish-speaking, Vietnamese-speaking areas in Chicago. But it used to be that for every immigrant group in Chicago and other major cities, there would be some enclave. And then you could feel at home and you had that support. The Chinatowns in America are famous and so on for that. My dad didn't have that when he came. My Chinese wife didn't have that when she came. She was the only student, one of two or three students from China by the end of her time as a student in our university. But you didn't really have that probably, did you, Anya? Because there used to be...
Not really, Larry. But, you know, when you're talking about all this, I'm thinking it probably was done intentionally. I didn't want to... dive very deep into the Russian community. I know from my experience working with different communities where they're located, and I know where the Russian community is, but I guess I just promised to myself to take the opportunities of this country. And I asked actually myself, do I want to settle myself in one particular community, which is the Russian community? Probably no. I like to take advantage of Russian culture. I don't, believe it or not, speak Russian a lot, only with my mom when I'm from Western Siberia, as you know, and my mom is in Siberia right now. She refuses to fly because of COVID, of course. And the only time I speak Russian is my mom. We speak almost every day over the technology. And yes, I could have be full-time in my Russian community, but I decided not to. But I'm still connected. I'm respectful, and I like Russian food. But when you were talking, when you said that you actually explain Chinese and Japanese or Asian culture mentality overall to the American students, it's even more interesting. As you well know, diversity and inclusion are very huge right now in business, in corporates, And one of my good friends, Bertine, who is promoting this work in Atlanta, Georgia, she invited me to her summit in October, and I was actually speaking about cultures. I love cultures. And it's amazing that you are doing the same type of work, because when I work with American companies and multicultural companies, which I had the experience of working with 200 cultures, I built a fascinating career on of interpreting on the video. It was medical interpretation. We provided the services for the entire country in the United States. 200 cultures. And the easiest way to explain, you smell 200 different kinds of food in the kitchen during the lunchtime. Sometimes it's not very pleasant smell. I have to admit that, but it's fascinating. And I honestly believe that America needs more inclusion and diversity, period. The idea of this country is immigration. If there is no immigration, there is no country. But at the same time, when we reach certain levels, we become so comfortable in our comfort zone, and we just don't want to change anything. We don't want to learn about another people, how they think, what language they speak, what kind of food they eat, what kind of clothes they wear, why they think this way. And I think it's fascinating that you are advocating for different cultures. It just adds into our neuroplasticity, my favorite word, and I love it. And it's great. It's great that you are promoting this other cultures into the American society, because we speak with Susan all the time how we can support immigrants from other countries by helping them to integrate into the American society. You're basically doing the same, but the opposite way. You're helping American mentality, American people learning about other cultures. It's great. It's wonderful. I didn't realize all this. Now it's like an aha moment for me.
Well, Anya, I've been teaching Asian languages for 41 years at the university level. And for one thing, it has grieved me during this time that the U.S., 14% of our population, and I think that's just legal immigrants, not to mention so-called illegal or undocumented, I should say, undocumented immigrants who I really feel for and want to see them supported too. But 14% of our population were born elsewhere, including you, my Chinese wife, and so on, my Pakistani neighbors. And it's part of what makes our country so strong, because we get the best people from
Absolutely.
Around the world.
Absolutely.
Like what Donald Trump said, you know, Mexico isn't is sending us their worst people. Well, not only is that not true, but I mean, you and I are visiting via Zoom. Who created Zoom? A Chinese immigrant from Shandong province and so on.
There you go.
And so we need to celebrate that. Also, if the U.S. wants to continue, as it seems to insist on, to being the dominant country in the world, economically, politically, militarily, it behooves us to understand other countries better, but we don't. And language requirements are being reduced. Interest in studying foreign languages is even less now in the U.S. than it's been in a long time. We've seen program cuts too. When things are cut, it's the humanities and the things that make us more human, and that includes language and learning about other cultures. And not only is it important in our interactions with immigrants from countries from around the world, and America is the biggest, if not melting pot. Hopefully we melt together and create this wonderful enterprise together. But not only that, in learning to deal with people from other cultures in our own country, in our own neighborhood, Chinese neighbors, Pakistani neighbors, in this really nice neighborhood in which we live in West Michigan. where there are 70 different languages spoken in our county. And this isn't Chicago. This is West Michigan, for goodness sakes. You know, this is Grand Rapids and Muskegon and Holland, Michigan. But there are 70 languages spoken. Anyway, but 70. Not only that, but then as we deal with the rest of the world as the number one economy still and the unquestioned number one superpower, we need to deal with the rising superpower that is China and other countries and understand them so much better than we do. And yet, anti-intellectualism in the U.S. has been rampant for ever and continues to be. And then an administration like the Trump administration that says not just America first, but America only, and disregarding, not even trying to understand or appreciate our allies in Western Europe, let alone anyone else, and seeing the world as enemies, that's a terrible way to live. And what I have always emphasized, Anya, in my 41 years of teaching is how much we can learn from other cultures. For example, in teaching about Japan, there is, Japan has its weaknesses, every society does, but wherever the U.S. is weak, Japan is strong in terms of social mores, social customs, and wherever Japan is weak, the U.S. is strong in things like creativity. But the Japanese are masters at civility, of politeness, of working together as a group, of putting the group ahead of their own selfish desires. Many Americans would criticize and say, too much so. But then in America, we live in concentric circles of narcissism, as one of my colleagues says. We're so individualistic to a fault, the Japanese probably to a fault, too group-oriented. But nevertheless, and they teach teamwork, humility. The Japanese hardly ever use the word I, me, or my. And so, for example, this was done 30 years ago, but I don't think there would be any difference now. And it was done with the approval of the participants in Japan and the U.S. who were being used for this psychological experiment or linguistic experiment. AT&T got the approval of several thousand Americans to do this, monitor their phone conversations with friends. And the same thing with the NTNT, the equivalent of AT&T in Japan, for several thousand Japanese. And I mean, the people knew they were being listened in on, so they didn't reveal anything too personal. But in the average 25-minute conversation, Americans mentioned the word I, me, or my about 40, 50 times. And the Japanese, once. Wow. On average, in 25 minutes. It's implied in their verbs of humility as opposed to honorific. You honorably do something, I humbly do something. It's part of the verb. And the separate words that you use to honor other people and humble words for yourself and so on. This is something Americans could learn. Both the Chinese, Japanese, and the Koreans as well don't like talking about themselves. They feel like that's boasting, bragging, including about their family members. And when I first went to Taiwan, my previous marriage, but my wife was a very successful singer, still is, and I would boast about her. And my Taiwanese friends, I mean, they were really put off by that, and I could realize that because it was like I was boasting about myself, and in a way it is, you know, by projection. And so one of the things we can learn about as Americans, born and bred from cultures like in Asia, is that sense of humility, of sacrificing often your own personal desires for what's good for the group, for your family, for your organization, for your country. I'm not going to wear a mask, you know. Asians don't question that. They don't question that. Nobody in Japan, China, or Korea is on the street saying, oh, the government, you know, liberate us from having to wear masks. It's been part of the culture anyway to protect themselves and others, whether it's pollution or they have a cold or flu. They wear a mask so they don't infect others. But Americans think that's such an imposition. There are things we can learn from these. Yes, there are things that these cultures can learn from us. And the Japanese have hired 50 some of my graduates to go teach in their schools for up to 5 years to teach English, but also about American culture. And trying to encourage not only English language ability, but creativity and independent thought and so on in a society that does emphasize the group too much over individual desires and conformity, perhaps too much. But so there's so many reasons why, and in this interconnected world, with global climate change, with terrorism, with the economy. We're all interlinked in this small blue-green planet. And as Martin, I used to start my classes in Japanese with a quote from Martin Luther King. This is from the 1960s, and already Martin Luther King was able to say that he could fly from Tokyo, Japan, to San Francisco or Los Angeles in California, and by his watch, arrive before he left because of the time change. And he said, in a world that is that where you can virtually fly anywhere in 24 hours, we either learn to live together as friends or we'll die together as fools. And we're continuing to die together as fools in so many different ways. And seeing the other as enemy, and diversity and inclusion is all about loving thy neighbor as thyself. And as I have my students, I ask them in Chinese these days, who is your neighbor? And the answer is, everybody in the world is my neighbor.
Love it.
And that's
love
true.
It.
You know,
yeah, so, it's so true. Yeah.
Right, we're so interconnected.
We are. And it's fascinating you are talking about Japanese culture right now, mentality. Well, first of all, that's another promise I made to myself when I said, I want to take the opportunities of this country, and I want to be the best hybrid possible of both countries, because Russia gave me a lot, and this country gave me and has been giving quite a lot, and I'm still figuring out, right? So, but I want to be that perfect blend, because both countries, both cultures have good and bad, but I decided to take good, and I hope it's working. But coming back to Japanese experience, I built a team of female leaders. My podcast we're interviewing for right now, My American Dream, got the grant from Write Your Future. And it's by Lancome. Lancome, it's a big beauty brand. Parisienne, a French one. And I built the team of female leaders because this grant promotes ladies in education, careers, and business through learning English. And we're using the platform, which is called Voxy. So basically what ladies do, they study English on their own time. There are certain requirements. What I'm trying to say that I get referred ladies from Japan quite a lot for this team. And now I am getting this experience of working with Japanese women, which is so fascinating. And everything you said, I see it. They're very respectful. You never hear them scream and shout. They respect your time, and I just like how they carry themselves. I would like to see a little bit more initiative from them, but overall respect. That's how I think of Japanese culture. And I really enjoy, and I'm learning from them as students who carry a different culture, and also women, because they're all wives, and the way they talk about their families and their husbands. We had a team meeting last Friday. One of the ladies, she connected with us at 8 o'clock in the morning in Japan, and it was 5 o'clock in Chicago at night. And when I introduced everybody, we got connected, we did the icebreaker, and I said that lady was connecting from Japan. And as I was telling all this in my mind, I'm thinking, oh my gosh, we're so global. There are no boundaries to anything anymore. And like you say, it's either we're living together or we just built these walls and we're just kind of minding our own business. I think it's mind blowing, don't you think so?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, by the way, the quote, I didn't quite get the quote right because I haven't used it in some years. I got the gist of it right. But what Martin Luther King said was a little stronger even than what I said. We need to learn to live together as brothers and sisters.
Yes.
Or we'll die together as fools. Anyway, that's just really lovely thing. Beethoven's Ninth and Ode to Joy, Schiller, Alle Menschen werden Brüder. Everyone will be brothers and sisters. Anyway, but with Japanese women, I have two Japanese colleagues. I began as the only Japanese teacher at my university, and then I have hired colleagues, and now now that I don't teach Japanese anymore, I leave the program to them. And these two women who are middle-aged are pretty much the two most gracious people I have ever met, which is saying something, because the circles I move in university, Christian university, where people live up to that name, and also in the symphony world, are gracious people. But these are the most gracious, and I've kept emails from both of them over the years because they just make you cry by how very sincerely gracious and humble they are. Now, but you mentioned, yeah, you'd like to see them take more initiative. Now, Japanese women are not as equal with men in their society as Chinese women are in theirs, or American women, or Russian women. And so they have not been used to being able to assert themselves the way a Chinese woman would. And they're very, very different cultures, by the way, and very different languages. And in Chinese, there's no difference in the way a woman speaks and the way a man speaks. In Japanese, it's completely different. They use different verbs. They use different words for I,
really?
Me, wow. And my, and so on. It's built into the language for women to be more subservient to men. And the word in Chinese, the Japanese borrowed 60% of their words from Chinese, and the whole written language. And the word that I teach in Chinese, juren, which means master, owner, like owner of a shop or business or whatever, or the host or the master of the house, juren, in Japanese means husband as well. As well as those things. And so my Chinese wife, which knows Japanese, when she married me, she said, I hope you realize that we're taking the Chinese definition of juren. You are not my juren. You are not my master, my owner, and so get busy and do the dishes. Oh, yes, dear. And so Chinese women these days in the cities are very much equal with men, and in Russia too. And my Russian colleagues, women colleagues, think of Olga Zabrikova in the Grand Rapids Symphony. She's very strong and assertive, more than her American husband, and so on, but not with Japanese women. And so in American society, they need to learn to advocate for themselves, right? And so they don't have to change being aggressive and sweet and, gracious and sweet and respectful. But on the other hand, in this society, as you know, Anya, you do have to advocate, as I say, for yourself. And
absolutely,
that's true in most societies in the world. And so, there's adapting to be done. America is a very strange and crazy place. And
it's very different. Yeah. It's very different. And I always tell that you need to figure out this country. When I came here, I wasn't taken with open arms. Everything was so different for me. Houston Airport, that's my port of entry. My first impression, I really loved how that lady distributed people so we avoid a waiting time. And in my head, I immediately thought, oh my gosh, such respect for people's time. And since that day, of course, I see it in many places. And I really love this. For example, speaking about good things in America, right? So everybody respects your time. It's just a wonderful thing. So Larry, when you think of somebody like your father who came here, immigrated many, many years ago, what kind of advice from today's perspective would you give to that young lad coming to the United States, pursuing his American dream?
Well, it was a lot harder for my father because he was 39 years old. These days, we have hundreds of thousands of students from other countries. They come as high school or college students. And so it's much easier for them, of course, to adapt, to learn the language, to make friends. America, for an older person like my dad coming at 39 years old, even if he had learned the language well, which he hadn't learned English language well, we're a very individualistic, very lonely society. We don't have much of a sense of community left in most places in the world. We don't tend to know our neighbors well. In a lot of neighborhoods, they have block parties or whatever, but we're in our own homes. We're in our cars rather than in mass transit. This country has fallen down so much in mass transit. Yeah, you have it in Chicago, but in Grand Rapids, we have some kind of bus system. In China, there are subways everywhere. You're always with people, and there is a much more sense of community in many, many other countries, probably most other countries in the world than the U.S. So it's really lonely. And I suppose my dad did the best he could. I wouldn't have any particular advice for him because he was outgoing and he was self-confident. But my advice to my students because I have sent so many dozens and dozens of graduates to teach in China, to teach in Japan, maybe 55, 60 of my graduates have gone, as I say, to Japan to teach for not just a brief period of time, but for up to 5 years. And some of them even stay, a few of them have married Japanese people and they're making their lives in Japan. And in China too, I've sent dozens of graduates to teach at English at Chinese universities. And I tell them, be brave, put yourself forward, take a chance when it comes to speaking the language. And in China and Japan, unlike, and I think in Russia this would be true to a lesser extent, not so much in France or Germany, where they're not so amazed that you can speak French or German, but in China, Japan, Korea, they're so amazed that a foreigner can say anything beyond hello that they give you great credit. And you make mistakes, like you were so gracious, I butchered Russian with, I studied 3 years of Russian, yeah, it didn't really show there, did it? But I used to get, it's been more than 40 years, actually, it should have been 45 years, so maybe you'll forgive me. But put yourself out there in making friends with other people and take a chance with language. And so what if people laugh at you? You laugh at your own mistakes. I've made my share of mistakes exactly. In the past, speaking Chinese or Japanese as well, said some funny things. But the Chinese and Japanese are just real gracious because they know you're trying and you're honoring their culture and their language by attempting to do it instead of doing the typical American thing, or from other countries, it's not just Americans, that's true, just expecting the Chinese or the Japanese to speak their language, especially English. So I think that's the main thing, is to just be brave. I was good friends in graduate school with Zhou Zhiping, who for the last 30-some years, he's from Taiwan, and the last 30-some years, he's been the head of the Chinese program at Princeton University. And when Joe came over to the U.S. to study as a university student at Oberlin College, he didn't know that much English. And he said to me, Larry, when you learn, and by the time I knew him, his English was superb, but he said, Larry, when you are trying to learn a foreign language, you got to be shameless. By which he didn't mean do disgraceful things. He meant you got to just be brave enough to just go for it. And you make mistakes, so what? And so that's what I tried to tell my students too. While they're in class, I try to make it feel a safe environment for them, of course, and by being nurturing. And I am blessed with extremely gifted, extremely talented, hardworking students. So I have basically all A students. So that's not a problem. But then and we have small conversation groups weekly with native speakers, as I said, from China, but when they go over to China or Taiwan or Singapore, wherever they go, Chinese-speaking country or Japan, and then for our French, Spanish, German students and so on, Dutch students, be brave, put yourself out there, try to speak the native language, and learn. And that's how you're going to improve your language skills too, right? And your knowledge of the culture is by engaging in that language with people in that culture to which you have moved and are living. And so, yeah, and the more you interact with other people, and that's why you have this real outgoing, lovable personality. So and you're smart and know languages.
Larry, it took me a while. I lived in Ireland as well, and it's another story. Everybody loves it, my story, because when I graduated from my university in 2000 in Russia, I decided to travel somewhere to get some authentic experience of authentic English. And the opportunity came to go to Ireland. Everybody says, what? Ireland for authentic English, good luck. And I didn't realize back then, only when I came to Ireland and I heard they say, thank you very much, see you on Monday. And I said, whoa, this is not what I studied at the university. It was fantastic experience. And as you can imagine, I built some confidence there, right? It's not just a studying English at the university by the books. And we had a professor from America. Another year, we had a professor from England. So it kind of helped a little bit. But I went to Ireland and it helped even more. After Ireland, I came to the United States. And guess what? I was shy. And especially when people told me, oh, that accent you have, where are you from? And immediately that question only shut me down. And in my brain, I had that thought raising, oh my gosh, am I making mistakes or am I saying something wrong? And this is somebody with bachelor's degree in two languages and education, lived in Ireland. And when I work with people who come to my programs, especially when I prepare them for the citizenship interviews. And I always tell them, my goal for you when you come to my program is to build confidence, concrete confidence. It's not, yes, you will study 100 questions. You will learn read and write. You will learn your N400 application form. But what you really need is confidence. And it's true, and you are proving the same thing. Just be brave, be bold. And you know what actually helped me? I have American parents. I'm their daughter, they never had. And they live in Quad Cities, Illinois. It's on the border of Illinois and Iowa. That's where I lived for a while, briefly.
Wow. And
yes, my American mom, when I finally came back one night, I used to go to Iowa across the bridge to pump my gas because it's cheaper. And one night I came back and I was so upset. And my American mom asked me, Anya, what happened? And I said, I just stopped by that gas station and I was paying for the gas. And the gentleman got engaged into the conversation with me. And he asked me about my accent, and I'm tired of people asking me this question all the time. And she looked at me and she said, you know, next time when somebody asks you this question, oh, you have an accent. Where is this accent from? And you say, I have an accent? Oh, I thought you have an accent. And it just helped me right there. Well, first of all, it was so funny, we started to laugh. And since that day, that's what I tell people. I have an accent, you have an accent. And I tell them another thing. Yes, I'm from Russia, I might have an accent, but that's what makes me unique. I don't want to lose it. I'm Siberian. How many Siberians do you know? One or two? So. Well, honored, thank you. And I always tell them, always have the mindset that you speak the language of this country, or you're on the way to master English, to be successful in this country. On the top, you speak Spanish, you speak Bulgarian, you speak French, you speak Polish and many other languages. How many languages do you speak? Ask those people. And I find it very helpful when I work with people. So this is that piece of confidence that they get. And I think this is a good starting point for them, and overall puts them on the right path. I'm hoping I'm helping them with this. But I'm happy you are doing kind of the same thing. You tell them that you carry a different culture, you carry different skills, you carry a different language. And like my American uncle says, who has Irish blood, English blood, German blood in him, and he's American. He was born and raised here, eight Flaherty boys, eight boys in the family. And he loves immigration and immigrants. and we run a series of webinars with him on career resume. He worked with John Deere and he built successful IT business. And he supports me on anything related to immigration, because he always says, looking at me, and I will never forget the first time he told me, "You're so brave." And I said, "Why do you say this?" "Well, because you came from Omsk to the United States. The flight alone, the trip alone is 6,000 miles. That's already brave." He always reminds me of this. And yes, it's a great reminder, and I like to be reminded. But I always believe that, like you say, this country is fantastic and very unique because of all these cultures we have, especially Chicagoland. There is no such a place. I go to New York, San Francisco, New Orleans. I come back and I say, I'm home. I feel home in Chicago. I love to go and try Argentinian food, Cuban food, Mexican food, which was a big shock for me when I came to the United States. But it's wonderful. It's great. It's perfect. And I thank you for supporting all this and doing the same kind of work, but more for the American society. You are that advocate, cultural advocate for the American society. You show them that, hey, there is another way to think and speak a different language and eat different food. You're married to a different, to a woman from a different country and culture, and I'm sure that you experience all the different food, which is fascinating on its own. Well, Larry, thank you very much. It was fantastic. And I also know that you mentioned you wrote several books. Do you want to tell more about the books?
Oh, you're very kind to ask, Anya. Before I mention that and we conclude our wonderful visit together, I just want you to know how impressed I have been, how amazed and moved and just really very impressed with immigrants like you, like my Chinese wife, my German papa, my Pakistani neighbor, that you were brave enough, not only brave enough to come here and make a new life for yourself in a very different culture using a very different language, but to be successful in doing that. Most Americans don't speak, who weren't born in another country, weren't raised growing up speaking a language other than English with immigrant parents here. The great majority of so-called Americans can't speak any other language but English, and would never dare to do what you or my Chinese wife or my German pop or my Pakistani neighbor have done. And so I take my hat off to you.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you.
I think it's just absolutely wonderful. And I would like to point out that we're the society with the largest number of immigrants, at least traditionally we have been. Japan has pretty much the least of any major country, and they're suffering because of that. It's hurt their economy. Their birth rate is way down. I'm glad that they're not having as many children, but they're not welcoming to immigrants for various reasons, even whether it's intentional and also unintentionally, because of the nature of the language and the insular nature of Japanese communities and culture and so on. And they're much weaker because of it. And it's really hurt them. Anyway, so you were kind enough to ask about the books. Most of the books that I've written and the most successful were always co-authored with my wife, were for students of the Chinese language. But our best-selling book is a book for China travel these days. Few people are traveling to China because of COVID-19 and because of the animosity the Trump administration has drummed up against China and all the restrictions. But we sold tens of thousands of copies of our very humorous but helpful China Survival Guide for China Travel. There's a lot of information about culture. My second to last book that I published, this came out a year or two ago, called China Smart, what you don't know, what you need to know. And it's a different short, interesting essay about China in the past, China in the present, and Chinese culture divided into those three sections with an emphasis on contemporary China, but things like population, growth and problems for young people and pollution and how the government works and the education system and so on, things like that, also environmental concerns in China and on and on. So I'm really happy about that book, and I get to teach a Zoom course on that for
continuing
education.
Larry, are those books in English?
Yes. So even the books that we wrote in the Chinese language, they have both Chinese and English, and China Smart is just in English. Our travel book is just in English. And they're all available on Amazon. And you can see a list of books, Larry Herzberg, on Amazon. These days, our biggest seller is not something that would interest your audience. It's obviously just for students of the Chinese language.
I'm sure many people listen to this podcast, and it's multicultural, and many people would be interested in traveling, reading about traveling in China. Why not?
Well, here's another book. I'm sorry, I should have, one of our most successful books is just for general public. I shouldn't fail to mention our we have the most popular book on Chinese proverbs and popular sayings, and that's just, well, it gives the Chinese and a literal translation and then a more poetic translation, but an explanation. And the proverbs and sayings are divided into chapters based on the theme. And so, and then I have an introduction to each chapter about what does this show about the Chinese view of learning, of education? What does it show about their view toward friendship, the view toward time, and the value of time as one of the most precious things we have, and family, and so on. Money, and on and on. So, I was going to say, these days, it has amazed me. It's absolutely amazed me, because my wife and I wrote the book just to benefit our students at Calvin studying Chinese language with us. But it's become a major hit with already 20,000 copies sold, and that's our little book on the basic patterns of Chinese grammar, and telling students all the major grammar patterns and giving sample sentences and then samples of what not to do, what not to say, butchered Chinese. And and we've made several films, which we have used our endowment fund money to distribute to colleges, universities, and many high schools across the U.S. to try to give Americans a more nuanced view of China. And so we produced two films, my wife and I, on contemporary China. And the one is China Today, Issues That Trouble Americans About China in the 21st Century. And the other one, which is, I think, more significant, 2.5-hour film, which is just in English, is called The China Threat, Perception Versus Reality. We do not need to see China as an enemy. Yes, they're a challenge, but we can partner with them on so many things, including global climate change.
Absolutely.
Which the Biden administration will, but which the Trump administration doesn't even believe is an issue.
Larry, where are those available? The movies for the public?
I'm afraid that, I mean, I just distributed for free copies of these, and I can, anyone who's interested can email me at herz@calvin.edu, herz@calvin, calvin.edu, and I can send them for free the Vimeo link so that they could watch it streamed. But I suppose, yeah, they could get a DVD copy these days. My students don't even want the free DVD copies I offer them.
It's kind of old school for some people.
yeah, old school folks like me. But now only about 1/3 of my students take me up on that offer, and instead they just say, "We'll watch the streamed video on Vimeo." fine. So they're welcome. I'd love to distribute that.
Thank you for your generosity.
We're trying to push back against the demonization of China by our politicians and the media, which is really dangerous. Having Trump administration has started this, or made even stronger the Cold War that had already been really started with China, and which is unnecessary. They're going to be a rival, they're going to be a challenge, there are going to be a lot of things they do that we don't like, but on the other hand, we can partner, as I say, with them in a lot of things. They're also against global terrorism as well, and they've done amazing things in fighting global climate change recently, and so on, and economically too. And it doesn't have to be a winner-take-all scenario. It isn't a it can be a win-win game if we cooperate economically as we have in the past. So that's the work that I've
thank
been
you.
Doing.
Thank you, Larry, for your time today. Wonderful interview. We started from Germany. We dived into Asia. Thank you for your passion and being a strong advocate for the cultures and putting it out there. It's great. We need this. We need more of it. And I'm so happy we got connected.
Oh, I am too, Anya.